Welcome to Global Investment Voice, where we explore investment migration issues and opportunities from around the world. With a special focus on the U.S. EB-5 Immigrant Investor Program, we'll also cover citizenship and residency by investment programs from around the globe. If you're an investor, fund manager, developer, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of these global investment migration programs, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host attorneys, Mona Shaw and Rebecca Singh, as well as other investment migration leaders from around the world. So let's get into Global Investment Voice.
Mona, we are back. What's this topic about Chevron and the dock?
Well, I thought that was a good title.
It could be. What's it about?
Well, there was a couple of momentous decisions by the Supreme Court just recently. And the Supreme Court, after 40 years, overturned Chevron. And to our global listeners who may not be familiar, even our local listeners who may not be familiar with this topic, just a few days ago, the U.S. Supreme Court of the United States, in arguably what I would say is the most significant decision of this year, delivered a stunning rebuke to what I would call overreaching regulators, or maybe all agencies, by overturning a 40-year-old law, and that's known as the Chevron Doctrine. I can tell you, the Wall Street Journal had stated, and I love this phrase, I've just been calling it this all the time, instead of the Chevron document, I call it the pernicious legal doctrine, because it essentially gave government agencies an unfair advantage in court. Government agencies who we deal with all the time, like USCIS and the SEC. But just to give you a little background about the case actually has nothing to do with immigration, has nothing to do with the SEC. It's actually a fisheries case. And the case was called, LOPA Bright Enterprises and Raimondo. And everybody now nicknames it LOPA. The actual LOPA case basically surrounds efforts by a group of fishing companies to contest regulatory interpretation from the National Oceanic, and I believe it was the Marine Fisheries Agencies. Well, anyway, the agencies covering what they do, and required them to compensate federal inspectors to check for non-compliance. And they were really upset about all of that. They went to the Court of Appeal, all the way up to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals found for the government, based on the Chevron Doctrine, which allows courts to give the agencies deference, meaning that all agencies have the first foot forward, so to speak.
Oh.
Then the fishing company said, okay, we don't care. We are going to go to the Supreme Court. And everybody was surprised when the Supreme Court, who didn't have to, picked this up and then came back and overturned a 40-year-old doctrine.
So I have to ask, I think I know where this is going with giving agencies more power, but Mona, I got to ask, how does this really affect EB-5?
Well, I predict this decision is fated to have wide-reaching effects, especially in EB-5. Out of all of immigration, there are other immigration areas which we'll discuss, but I do believe EB-5 is going to be the one who are going to take this to the furthest point. Because, you know, EB-5 practitioners, up to now, we are frustrated over and over again, or we have been frustrated rather over and over again, because we believe that USCIS has far too much leeway. It oversteps its boundaries in all matters, including evaluations of unclear language in bill. So previously, where there was any ambiguity, the courts had to go towards the agency. Now, because of this decision, they now can be a little more independent, and it means that both sides start on an equal footing. You know, this precedent is going to rock USCIS and other governments' collective boats.
Well, helping us explore today's topic is Cyrus Mehta. Cyrus is a managing partner of Cyrus D. Mehta and Partners in New York City. And for over three decades, he has helped corporations and individuals from around the world in a variety of immigration matters, including business, employment, entrepreneur and investment immigration, as well as asylum and ethics cases. Cyrus, welcome to the show.
It's great to be on the show. Thank you very much.
Hey, Cyrus, I've been reading your excellent blog articles over the years, and I have to tell you, they're just getting better and better. But I do note from your last one that you're not a fan of the overturning of the Chevron deference, unlike myself, are you?
Yeah, thank you, Mona, for the compliment. I just love writing blogs, and I'm glad that they're helpful to other lawyers and to
the
client community.
Definitely.
When you say I'm not as much of a fan, I just thought I would present a more balanced picture because there are going to be winners and losers with the overturning of Chevron. Clearly, the winners are those who practice in the employment-based area or in the immigrant visa arena. It may be possible to go into federal court and get a better interpretation on a statute that may have been interpreted rather broadly by the agency.
You know, Cyrus, I've just called it the most significant decision of this year. But really, for the layman and for our global listeners who really don't understand U.S. politics or how the Supreme Court works, or really the significance of such a decision, how much of a big deal is this decision?
It is quite a big deal because until now, the courts were required to give deference to an agency's interpretation of the statute. If you're talking about immigration law, then the courts have always given deference or paid respect to the USCIS's interpretation of an employment-based provision involving H-1 visas, L-1 visas, or even EB-5 petitions. With the fall of Chevron, the court will no longer be giving deference to the agency's interpretation. And one can go into federal court and try to get the court to issue an interpretation that would be consistent with what Congress intended.
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from. To me, it's fantastic. It means that, especially in EB-5, where we have so many ambiguous policies and ambiguous sections of law that no one understands, and then USCIS will come up in their wisdom and suddenly define something in a certain way. It's wonderful. But outside of employment-based visas, it doesn't really affect immigration judges, right?
No, it doesn't. It absolutely does not. The immigration judges basically rule based on what they are bound by under the Board of Immigration Appeals precedents. So yes, in some ways, immigration judges are bound by the Board of Immigration Appeals, but Chevron, or the fall of Chevron, clearly applies to the Board of Immigration Appeals. The Board of Immigration Appeals has been notorious in interpreting provisions of the Immigration Act really broadly. And I think one can now challenge the BIA's interpretations of the statute.
Yeah, well, that is a good thing on that side. But let's move back to the employment base for a second. So now that basically the person coming in and the agency are on an equal footing, which has never happened before, or at least not for the last 40 years, what do you see the courts doing? Do you feel that the courts are going to be a sort of unsure, they're still going to have a Chevron sort of attitude? What do you see happening?
It remains to be seen, but it doesn't seem like the administrative state has been completely dismantled because there's still something known as Skidmore deference. There was a...
I heard that. What is Skidmore?
So Skidmore was a case that preceded Chevron. And under Skidmore versus Swift and Company, what Quilt said there was that you should still give some respect to an agency's interpretation of a rule, but it is based on the thoroughness evident in its consideration, the validity of its reasoning, its consistency with earlier and later pronouncements, and those factors which give it power to persuade if lacking power to control. So what this means is that you should still give some deference to an agency's interpretation of the statute, if it makes sense, if it is persuasive.
Right.
It is a much lower standard than the Chevron deference, where you must give respect to the interpretation of the agency, and if you don't agree with it, as long as it's a reasonable interpretation.
So it's a may do instead of a must, basically.
That's right.
Right. Well, in your own blog, you mentioned that it will open up challenges to outdated labor certification recruitment.
Yes, I thought about that, and I think that would be interesting because if you really look at the statute, the labor certification statute under which the whole labor certification program is derived from, this is under Section 212A5. All it says is that the Secretary of Labor must certify that there are not sufficient workers who are able, willing, or qualified and available at the time of the application. That's all the statute says. But based on that, out of whole cloth, the Labor Department has just created a whole bureaucracy requiring advertisements, 2 Sunday advertisements, 3 additional recruitment steps, the business necessity doctrine, And the whole labor certification recruitment basically is a test of the labor market. It's not really a job creation program as such.
Yeah.
I can see this being challenged with the downfall of Chevron.
Yeah. Well, Justice Roberts did say that courts must exercise their independent judgment. And hopefully their independent judgment will be in 2024 and not, well, 1824 or something. Or 1990 when IMAC came in and the rules were different. Cyrus, do you see, as we now have this open door for challenges, who do you think is going to fund some of the challenges to some of immigration's most unfavorable policies?
Well, I think you'll have immigrants, non-citizens. You may have investors who may want a better interpretation of the EB-5 statute under INA 203B-5, because even that's pretty bare bones. And you have all these regulations requiring source of funds and what counts as an investment and what does not, and what's job creation. All that could be subject to challenges by EB-5 investors.
Yeah, well, actually, Mark was asking me just earlier, Mark, how does it really affect EB-5? And I'll tell you one area. For example, drivers have been classed as employees, like Uber drivers, throughout the country. And the test is independence. How independent are they? So if you have a situation whereby they're not independent, they don't run their cars, they don't understand their schedule, but if they still get paid a 1099, immigration said, well, no, it's still a 1099. We're going to close our eyes on everything else and we don't care. And I'm hoping now that this whole deference has been removed, that courts will have the intelligence to say, no, that doesn't make sense. Even if they're paid a 1099, they're still an employee.
Yeah, that's right. That could well be the case.
Yeah. So there's issues within EB-5 statutes. And of course, as you say, all the source of funds issues, path of funds, which is really a problem at the moment.
Yes, absolutely. You know, so for example, if you buy a business from somebody like the owner who used to own the business and you pay that person $1 million or even more, and that has resulted in 10 jobs, that doesn't count as an investment because you gave the owner the money. It wasn't invested in the business. So, you know, all those kind of interpretations are not grounded in the statute.
I think that's just so important. But do you see that it's going to force immigration to come up with maybe narrower statute or more highly defined statutes?
I think time will tell, because I can see immigration, the DHS and its component, the USCIS, pushing back. They're going to basically argue that they do have implied authority to interpret the statute. There is a provision in the Immigration Act that allows them to administer the act in whichever way they see fit and in their discretion. And they can use that provision to argue that Congress has still delegated that authority of interpreting the statute to them. It remains to be seen whether a court will agree with that. But I see that as an issue, and I can see the DHS holding on and trying to maintain its ability to interpret the statute in the same way that it did before under the coverage of Chevron.
Right. Well, you did mention there are going to be winners and losers, and EB-5, I believe, is a winner. Who do you think are losers?
Well, I would hate to say that, but, you know, for example, if there are programs that have been implemented by the DHS to help non-citizens, and if there was no clear statutory authority, I can see the anti-immigrant groups attacking those programs. For example, work authorization programs, F1 OPT, H4 EAD, these are spouses of H1Bs, yes. Even DACA recipients.
Well, how do you see that, Cyrus? I mean, a lot of our listeners are on OPTs or know of someone and an H1B.
There is a counter argument. There is clearly a counter argument, because even if the anti-immigrant groups are sharpening their knives, I think the counter argument with F1 OPT is that it is grounded in the statute, because a court, the DC Circuit Court of Appeals, did kind of rule that they were not just relying on Chevron, but they were also relying on the statute that gave the DHS authority to decide how much time a non-immigrant can spend in the U.S. Therefore, if the DHS decided that a student should remain in the U.S. for 1 year or 3 additional years after graduation, they have the authority to do that in the statute itself. There's also another provision, a broad provision, that allows the DHS to issue employment authorization to just about any category of non-citizens.
Right.
And that's what DACA is premised upon. So therefore, there is still statutory authority, even for programs that don't have that explicit permission in the statute, but there is still that authority, and it can be argued that these programs are still lawful and they're within the confines of the Immigration and Nationality Act.
Well, the immigration system in the U.S. desperately needs an overhaul. We all know that. Don't you feel that opening up at least a glimmer of light at this point, we could open up some of the issues and really try and reform from within?
You know, it's really a double-edged sword. Yes, if Congress reforms the Immigration Act, that's what we need. We need a complete update and reform of the Immigration Act. But Congress is polarized, and it has not passed any meaningful immigration reform. So we have to depend on executive authority. And therein lies the challenge with the downfall of Chevron, because if you have a pro-immigrant administration, such as Biden's or prior to that, Obama's, and where they tried to use their statutory authority indirectly to implement DACA or other types of deferred action for non-citizens who were otherwise vulnerable, those could be attacked without Chevron because the administration will no longer be given deference.
Yeah, but the converse is also true. We all remember the last Trump era when I don't believe any firm who practiced immigration law did not see the consequences of Trump's policies, from consulates to, you know, locally here in the U.S. I mean, that was a disaster for immigration lawyers.
Absolutely. So if you have a Trump administration, then you can use the downfall of Chevron again to attack Trump's policies because they're not consistent with the statute. If, on the other hand, you have a pro-immigrant administration that tries to use the Immigration Act creatively to provide more benefits and amelioration to non-citizens in the U.S., those could come under attack by anti-immigrant organizations and even states like Texas that have attacked the Biden administration on the way they have prioritized enforcement. Now, the good thing there is, if you heard, there was the Mayorkas memo that prioritized who should be deported from the U.S., and it sensibly said that we don't have the resources to deport millions of people, so we will prioritize our resources. Texas sued, trying to invalidate the Mayorkas memo.
Yeah.
The administration won in the end because they were able to successfully argue, and this went to the Supreme Court, that Texas just did not have standing to show any injury, because that's another doctrine. Because if you want to attack a federal program, you have to show that you will be injured and you must suffer an actual injury in fact. And if you're just going to manufacture the injury, saying that, well, it'll be more expensive for us to issue driver's licenses to people who benefit with EADs, for example, that may not wash anymore because the standing requirements have been elevated by the Supreme Court in recent times.
Mm. You know, who would have thought fishing companies could rot so much? It's interesting to see how it
does. Yes, and this is only from an immigration perspective, Mona, because if you're practicing in the EP area, let's say you're an environmental rights activist or attorney, I think the downfall of Chevron will be very problematic because the whole idea of Chevron was to uphold the EPA's interpretation of statutes, and the EPA was essentially trying to protect the environment. That's the whole idea of dismantling the administrative state. It's not really aimed at immigration. It's aimed at the environmental movement. So industry may feel that they'll benefit now because you won't have these cumbersome environmental regulations, which will be set aside because they're not consistent with the Environmental Protection Act.
Yeah. You know, Cyrus, these last few months have just been a series of decisions from the Supreme Court, from a very Republican Supreme Court, I can say. And before I move on to that other second momentous decision, which came out on the very same day as the overturning of Chevron, we have a decision back a few months ago, Corner Post. That has also significance for this.
Yeah, Corner Post actually came out just after Loper-Bright.
Oh, it did? I thought it was back in February.
Well, that was when the oral argument took place.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was a foregone conclusion at oral argument that the Supreme Court would rule in this way, which they did. And in Cornopolis, what the Supreme Court did was to say that if you want to attack a regulation, there's a 6-year statute of limitations to do that under the Administrative Procedure Act. And that 6 years will not really apply. It will only apply from the time a plaintiff has suffered injuries. So even if somebody wants to attack a regulation that was issued years ago, that can now be attacked as an impermissible interpretation of the statute under Loper Bright.
Right, right.
So Cornopolis has given more ammunition in tandem with Loper Bright to attack regulations that were promulgated years ago.
Cyrus, could you give us a little bit more background on Cornopolis?
Yeah, so Cornopolis again was about regulation that had the statute of limitations that expired, but the plaintiff there had suffered recent injury, and the plaintiff there argued it was a truck stop.
Well, Cyrus, can you give a quick example of how Cornopolis can help some of our listeners who are in the immigration arena?
Yeah, so let's say you want to attack the labor certification regulations. I told you about how they're susceptible to attack now. And even though 6 years have passed since the labor certification rules were promulgated, they were promulgated last in 2005 and then another version in 2007, the 6-year statute of limitations won't apply to somebody who has suffered injury under these regulations now and wants to attack the whole edifice of the labor certification procedure.
Well, let's hope that people actually do take this up and go forward, because litigation is not cheap in this country.
Lawyers got to make their money.
Yeah, actually, I think one other area, and this has nothing to do with Cornopolis, Mona, but I think it's really interesting. In the extraordinary ability arena, EB1, you know, here too, the USCIS has just invented the final merits determination. So even though somebody actually met 3 out of the 10 criteria to demonstrate extraordinary ability, the USCIS has said that, well, that's not good enough. We now have to do a second evaluation to see whether you're truly extraordinary, even though you met the requirements of the regulation. I think that's also vulnerable to attack after Loper Bright.
But that one is definitely a worthy candidate, because many of these candidates are truly EB1s, and it just takes a stubborn officer to really throw a spanner in the works.
Yes, I agree. And they're doing that more and more. You know, they acknowledge that the candidate meets more than 3 out of the 10 criteria under extraordinary ability, but still deny it on the grounds that you're not good enough. You're not extraordinary enough.
Well, the Supreme Court has certainly done lots of favors to immigration lawyers, Cyrus, because their second case, which just recently came out, or rather I should say third case, the SEC versus Jarkissi, has a direct benefit for immigration law and EB5 lawyers.
Yes, it does. So when Jarkissi was argued and when the Fifth Circuit actually ruled in favor of Mr. Jarkissi, he was being subject to administrative fines, and this was an administrative hearing. And Jarkissi said that he was entitled to a jury trial under the Seventh Amendment, which you don't get in an administrative proceeding.
Yes, not under the SEC for sure.
That's right. So Jarkissi took it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court agreed that any claim that has a common law character, a claim that would otherwise be heard in a court of law historically involving fraud, which would typically be an SEC enforcement proceeding, the person subject to such an administrative enforcement proceeding is subject to a jury trial. And that's what the Supreme Court held. There were other grounds that were also argued.
Cyrus, before we jump on, why is this so important? Why is being allowed to be in front of a jury trial so important?
Well, because you get more protection. You have, if you're being attacked and your property is being taken away, you have more rights if you go before a jury of your peers.
And perhaps more understanding as well than some of these lawyers who perhaps never really understand the realities of business, which is where a lot of these SEC cases are coming from.
Yes. And then, of course, when it's administrative law, yeah, sometimes the odds are stacked against you.
Right.
If you're the respondent in an administrative proceeding, and then you don't have the same right of appeal even within the administrative system.
Right. So in front of a jury trial, would that still be in securities court, or could that be in any court?
Well, again, Jarkissi was about securities, and there was speculation whether this would actually undermine the whole administrative system and in immigration law. Would this impact the Board of Immigration Appeals? Would this undermine the ability of administrative law judges to do hearings on LCA violations under the H-1B provisions? It seems from Jarkezi that it was more limited because in that holding, the Supreme Court did kind of make a mention of the fact that certain proceedings didn't have a common law character, such as an immigration proceeding, because there Congress has power to administer the Immigration Act. And therefore, even if there's no jury trial, it's not a violation of your Seventh Amendment. I think Jarkezi clearly limited its holding to other areas, but there are many other agencies that would be subject to a jury trial. You know, for example, EPA, the FDA, the Department of Justice, the HUD, for example, the Treasury Department, the USDA, all those have enforcement hearings, and a person now subject to those can argue that he or she should be subject to a jury trial.
Yeah, and I think just for our listeners, I think it's important, perhaps, Cyrus, you could explain as well, how administrative law judges, they're appointed, they're not elected. And in other courts, judges are elected. And there is a difference, I believe, when you have an administrative judge who's appointed, especially if he's been appointed by a certain pro-right or pro-left administration.
Well, you know, here, Mona, I think even a federal court judge is appointed. A federal court judge is never elected. It's a state court judge that may be elected, but we're talking about federal courts.
Well, I'd just like to let our listener understand the significance of this. It's just how it is that having a jury trial is now so significant.
Yeah, so I think when you're in federal court before a judge, the judge is neutral. The judge is a learned lawyer. Even if the judge has a certain ideology, the judge knows the law. You're not dealing with a non-lawyer official in an administrative proceeding. And so you have more rights, the more due process protections, and better rights on appeal.
Yeah, well, since I've written in our blog, I do believe that deference doctrines result in more arbitrary rules, more investigations, and more findings of violations, especially in the SEC context. And ultimately, really, I would say in more intrusive government. So I am all for these decisions. How does it actually affect moving away from securities lawyers? You see, how does it affect immigration?
So immigration lawyers who practice in the EB-5 area are sometimes subject to SEC rules.
No, I think we're always subject to SEC rules.
So if you're subject to SEC rules and you're now subject to an enforcement proceeding, you could potentially attack that under Jarkezi and argue that it's not valid and one should be given a trial before a jury in federal court. And so one could create an obstacle if one is a lawyer being subject to an enforcement proceeding by the SEC.
Yeah, and I can see that happening. We've got some stubborn lawyers who have challenged the SEC in the past. So to me personally, I think these decisions are overall a good thing.
Yes, I think they're a good thing.
They alter the balance of power, basically, I believe.
Yeah, they do alter the balance of power. All I want to say is that at times we've had to rely on executive actions to protect immigrants, and the administration has relied on Chevron to withstand any attacks to its executive actions, and those will be more vulnerable. And the executive has used its power to provide relief to millions of immigrants. And I'm just hoping that the dismantling of Chevron does not result in the dismantling of these programs. As I said, I believe that there is statutory authority for these programs too, but it remains to be seen how the courts are going to react to attacks to those programs going forward.
Well, Cyrus, your blog is fantastic. I would recommend any of our listeners to go to your blog.
Thank you. I just also want to give credit to my co-author, Caitlin Bach. She's my senior associate. And if you're referring to the blog that we spoke about, she's also a co-author, so I just wanted to give her credit.
What's the name of your blog again?
It's the Insightful Immigration Blog.
That's right.
Excellent. And we'll make sure we put a link to that right here in the show notes. And Cyrus, thank you so much for coming on Global Investment Voice.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us today on Global Investment Voice. Do you want to get the most out of global migration and citizenship opportunities? Then head on over to our website at globalinvestmentvoice.com. From there, you can easily search and stream from hundreds of podcast episodes, as well as stay current with the latest migration news and investment opportunities by joining our insider newsletter. The topics presented in this podcast are informational in nature only and are not to be taken as specific legal, financial, or investment advice. Mona, Rebecca, and their legal staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com or by calling their New York office at 212-233-7473.